according to the Weather Service. And in weather in Washington, D.C., it is 73 degrees under partly cloudy skies. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features war in Sudan 1 year on. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shaw Mwiza Mutali. The music in the background is Uhuru Kwanza by Randy Weston. And we play that remembering his birthday, which is April 6th. April 15th marks 1 year since the war broke out in Sudan between the Sudanese armed forces led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, led by General Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, also known as Hemeti. Recent figures indicate over 9 million people have been displaced internally and externally as refugees abroad. And the United Nations World Food Program notes that roughly 18 million people face acute food insecurity. The war has impacted children heavily. It has been noted that as many as 19 million children are out of school due to the war. Recently, I had conversations unpacking the war situation in Sudan and the solidarity efforts with Sudanese to deal with the war's impact. The conversations dissected internal and external players, the role of multinational corporations, historic neoliberal policies which have undermined the country's food production, the tremendous role of the resistance committees in addressing the needs of the people, the solidarity efforts with Sudanese from abroad, and more. The conversations featured Dr. Nesrine El-Amin and Diana Konate. Scholar activist Dr. Nesrine El-Amin is assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and Department of African Studies at the University of Toronto and is a member of the Sudan Solidarity Collective in Canada. Diana Konate is the deputy executive director of policy and advocacy for the African Communities Together Act. First, we'll feature the discussion with Dr. Nesrine El-Amin. Nesrine El-Amin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me and for continuing to cover what's happening in Sudan so consistently.
Well, thank you, and thank you for all the work that you're doing under so much constraints as well, as I can imagine. And also, this hits home for you, so I can just imagine what you're going through. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us today. Before we get into the details of the war, could you just provide us a general, broad environment of what's happening now in Sudan?
Sure. So we're nearing the one-year anniversary of this brutal war that started on April 15th of last year. And, you know, in many ways, the situation continues to get worse. Violence has hit almost, you know, most parts of the country. Even in places that are relatively safe, the impact of it is still felt in the sense that there are acute food shortages, the planting season has been disrupted, the healthcare system for the most part has collapsed, the education system has collapsed, so there are about 19 million children out of school, over 1 million university students are not, you know, able to continue their studies. And, you know, I think about 25 million people are in dire need of food aid in a country that could very easily feed itself and that has in the past not only fed itself but been the kind of breadbasket of the region, right? And so, you know, I think that is one of the most concerning things for me right now, I have a lot of family that are still there, is that the food shortages are getting so acute that even if we in the diaspora are continuing, you know, to be able to send money home, either to our own families or to the local responders that I'm hoping we'll get to talk about more, that are really very heroic and sort of at the forefront of relief efforts in the absence of an international aid community. I mean, there are international NGOs operating, but not nearly in the way that we might otherwise see in situations like this. So people locally have had to kind of take the lead with these efforts. And so, yeah, I mean, I think for me, the biggest worry right now is that we're going to see many more deaths as a result of hunger, starvation, than bullets. And in the meantime, one of the warring factions, the Rapid Support Forces, are continuing to loot and pillage and really terrorize people in their villages and cities, using rape as a weapon of war. I would describe the kind of sexual violence as a pandemic almost. You know, it's very widespread, even though the cases are underreported, and some of that has to do with the collapse of the healthcare system and the kind of inability to really, verify or treat people who have been impacted by sexual violence. And then on the other hand, you have the Sudanese army that hasn't really been protecting people and often bombards civilian areas. We just saw reports of the army bombarding areas in Al-Fashir, in Darfur. And I should mention here too, as bad as the violence has been in the center of the country, especially around Khartoum and in the Jazeera, which is kind of like the agricultural heartland of the country, which is where part of my family's from, the violence is even worse in Darfur. And so we have to understand it as a continuation of the kind of genocidal violence that began in 2003. So I also just wanted to mention that. And also finally that it's very, very difficult to leave Sudan, right? Sudan borders 7 countries, and it's almost like people are trapped inside. To cross the Egyptian border at the moment, most people are having to pay upwards of $1,600 per person to essentially get smuggled in, because it's virtually impossible to get a visa at the border, at great risk to themselves. Lots of people, you know, there have been reports of people getting detained and then deported and so forth. And so there's also a kind of lack of, at the borders, there isn't enough kind of international observers allowing people to apply for asylum and, seek asylum, which is a basic right, you know. And so that is also something that I've been thinking about a lot, that 1 in 8 displaced people in the world is Sudanese. Over 10.8 million people are displaced, some from before the war, and then, you know, the vast majority since the war began. And yet no country has created a special visa program for Sudanese people. And so that is something that we in the diaspora are also trying to challenge and to push for, right? For countries to do what they did for Ukrainian refugees and others, to open the doors, create easy and affordable, right, free ways of for Sudanese refugees to claim asylum and to seek refuge.
And as you were talking, there's a couple points I wanted to unpack and expand on, particularly like the control of the country. You're saying that the most of the country right now is there's very little safety anywhere. Who controls what in the country? Which between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces? We mentioned Darfur, of course, because that's where they come from, and I guess we have to unpack that even more, because the Sudanese support forces are what was the Janjaweed back in the day.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you can just unpack
a little
bit.
Actually take a step back and just explain to people, because I think, you know, there was a military coup on October of 2021 that was orchestrated by both factions, the Rapid Support Forces, as you said, formerly known as the Janjaweed, and the Sudanese army. It's narrowly framed as having been triggered by security sector reforms, right, by an agreement that was about to be signed, or the kind of final parts of it implemented, that called for the Rapid Support Forces, which is kind of a paramilitary force, to be integrated into the army. And the dispute was whether that should take 2 years or 10 years. The RSF wanted it to take longer. But I think that really obscures the bigger picture, which is that these two factions are essentially vying for economic and political control of the country. Since April, various factions on either side have kind of joined. So that in some ways, it's gotten more complicated. It's drawn in more militarized factions, et cetera, since the war began. And so when I talk about, you know, they're vying for economic and political control, I think it's important to note that the RSF, its leaders control much of the illicit gold trade in the country and also parts of the livestock trade. And that gold gets funneled through the markets of the United Arab Emirates and then, you know, to Russia and other countries. And so the UAE in particular is playing a very negative role in this war by arming the RSF kind of in exchange for this gold. And, you know, they're pulling kind of these PR stunts. I just saw recently that they're opening a new hospital, along the border with Chad. Meanwhile, they're also shipping in arms through that border, right? So there's that. And then on the other side, we have the army, which controls much of Sudan's economy. Military elites have for a long time controlled, over 200 companies in rubber, cement, wheat, livestock, et cetera, real estate. And, and they are in turn backed by Egypt Sisi, Gulf Financing. Iran has recently also supported the army. So we see kind of this, the role of external actors here. The RSF, the Janjaweed, were legitimized by the European Union through something called the Khartoum process in 2014, through which the EU gave the RSF about 200 million to essentially allow them to externalize their border to the border between Sudan and Libya, and to use the RSF as a kind of border control, right? And you had both the army and the RSF send troops to fight in the war on Yemen on the Saudi coalition's behalf, so thereby kind of expanding their transnational networks. The UAE and Saudi Arabia have invested billions in Sudanese land and real estate and infrastructure under the Bashir regime over the last kind of 20 years. Under my estimates, about 27 billion, and they control more Sudanese land than all of Sudan's large domestic investors combined. And so to them, you know, there's also this kind of fear that a civilian government would undo all of those lucrative land deals business deals that they've signed over the last couple, over the last decades, and that would undermine their ability to continue extracting resources and to also like restructure Sudan's economy. I mean, I study land grabs, specifically Gulf land grabs and kind of community resistance to land grabs. And one of the things that became very clear to me at the beginning of the war is the ways that the food crisis, the hunger crisis that we're looking at now has been decades in the making, in part because of the ways the Bashir government, through neoliberal policies, really started kind of decimating the agricultural sector, plunging small farmers into debt, forcing them to then sell their land to government elites who in turn attracted foreign investors in land. And so we've seen a kind of proliferation of not only foreign but also domestic agribusiness in the agricultural heartland of Sudan, where people are mostly growing animal feed for export to dairy farms in the Middle East, and those products get resold to us in Sudan, decimating also the local local dairy production. It is actually among those dairy producers that have been dispossessed in this way that the RSF, as now one of Sudan's kind of largest employers, if you will, has found some of its most willing recruits, right? And so I think that is something to keep in mind, because we tend to naturalize war in the Horn of Africa. We tend to think of these areas as kind of already prone to famine and food crises. which is just untrue, right? We could be feeding the entire region, and yet it is because of these kind of neoliberal policies and, of course, climate change, et cetera, the climate crisis, that this is a man-made crisis, is what I'm trying to say. So in the first days of the war, when we escaped from Khartoum to rural areas just outside of Khartoum state, the first thing that I noticed was that all the rural stores were empty because they're so reliant now, more so than 10 years ago, on things being shipped in from elsewhere. That kind of dependence is relatively new, I would say, right? People used to have their own kind of, they used to farm subsistence crops much more than they do now. Many people have moved into other industries because they've had to kind of give up farming, and others are, again, involved in more agribusiness. So I just wanted to mention that as background, and I feel like I might have veered off the question a little bit, but that is, I think, something that's important to know.
No, I think it's a perfect part of the question about who controls what, and it provides the perfect nuance of why the war takes place. I mean, it just reminds me of when we're talking about the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Where you have the militia groups who are supported by some corporate interests who are taking out the resources from Congo. And it's a similar situation like you can see in Sudan, I guess. The way you've articulated it, it's very much makes perfect sense of the actors involved, which the media, the corporate media, does not really expand on. On purpose, and maybe accidentally doesn't expand on, but I also sometimes I think probably not trying to tell people the whole impact of why the war is taking place.
Right, and I should also mention, just as an added point, that we're still kind of trying to do some research on this as a Sudan Solidarity Collective, but I'm based in Canada right now, and 60% of the world's mining companies are registered here. And so a couple of weeks ago, we were invited to a protest in downtown Toronto because there's a Swedish, I believe Canadian company called the Lundin Group that was receiving an award at a mining gala, while at the same time being in discovery, right, being charged with aiding and abetting war crimes in Darfur. Specifically. And so, and this is, from like the, they're looking at their activities in 2003 around the beginning of the genocide in Darfur. And basically what they've sort of revealed is that this company essentially asked the Sudanese government to clear its like mining and oil exploration fields, right? The areas where they wanted to exploit, and that led to aerial bombardments and kind of the wiping out of villages at the very beginning of the genocide. So I think I mentioned this particular case because I think there's a lot of people in North America who think that this war in Sudan has nothing to do with them. And certainly, I think the Gulf states play a bigger role than the U.S. might. But there are also lots and lots of ways in which multinational corporations, including, for example, a Canadian PR firm that was hired by the RSF on two occasions now to kind of, clean up their image, that is run by an ex-Israeli intelligence officer based in Montreal. It's called Dickens and Madsen, I believe. And so I think part of what I want audiences in North America to know is that actually we are on some level implicated in this, because our pension funds, our university endowments, could be entangled in all of this. I think it's, again, our job to sort of make that clear and to show people how. But I think this is where the parallel with the Congo comes in as well, is that, in fact, Sudan is connected to Palestine, to Congo, to Haiti, right, through these kind of networks of corporations and other kind of external actors who are essentially benefiting off of death and destruction in our countries, right? And I think that's something that most people don't think about. They think about the war in Sudan as something that's very internal, far away, That it's just kind of like an internal civil war that has nothing to do with them. And I think we have to really try to challenge that and show people how we are, in fact, all in some ways, connected to what is happening there.
And again, that's Dr. Nisreen El-Amin. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and African Studies at the University of Toronto. And she's a scholar activist, and she's also a member of the Sudan Solidarity Collective. And we're looking at the war in Sudan 1 year on and looking at the nuances of the war and the actual issues which have spurred on the war. And as you're talking, and you're talking about the civilian components and also the in the corporate actors as well, one of the things that we were talking about earlier before we started the conversation was the this agreement that's been put forth by the TAGDOM coalition, which is the coalition that's Sudan's Coordination Alliance for Democratic Civilian Forces. And they just met in Addis Ababa. They said they have a plan to end the war and rebuild the country. And one of the members of that coalition, of course, is the former Prime Minister, Abdullah Hamdok. How do people see that coalition? Is it really representative of the people? And is it anywhere connected to the resistance committees, which were the people who actually brought about change in Sudan?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I should start by saying I'm not a political analyst. So, as such, I'm not an expert on kind of sort of high level politics that has been happening. There have been multiple tracks, peace talk tracks. Actually, peace talks is probably a misnomer because peace has never really been on the table. But there have been, talks in Jeddah, talks in Cairo, now talks in Addis. It's actually hard to keep up with how many different tracks are happening. And this is part of the problem. I think there needs to be a lot more coordination between the different kind of actors that are calling for negotiations and talks. One of the calls early on was to make sure that the external actors like Egypt and the UAE that are having a kind of negative impact on this war and intervening in negative ways should be present as well and should be held accountable. And only recently has that been taken more seriously. One of the things I think that a fatal mistake that has been repeated from the very beginning is that civilians, for the most part, have been excluded from these negotiations. And so I should qualify this. In particular, civilians who were at the forefront of the revolution, right? Those like the 8,000 resistance committees that exist across the country in Sudan that were really at the forefront of protest, that were warning the UN as it was coordinating, talks to kind of get Sudan back on track after the October 2021 coup, that they should not be legitimizing and propping up, the RSF and the army, specifically Hemeti and Al-Burhan as heads of these two factions, not framing that they should not be negotiating with them and propping them up, legitimizing them, that they should be, brought to trial because these are war criminals whose war crimes, span decades. And that call was not, the UN did not listen. And I think that's partly what got us to where we are today. And I feel like that mistake is being repeated again and again, where even now that civilian groups are represented on some level through this kind of coalition, these are civilian elites that are more accountable to external actors, I would say, than to the people of Sudan, and that have, for example, not condemned the RSF. In fact, some of them are, kind of official spokespeople for them. And so that in of itself, I think, tells you something. I don't think they can be trusted. And the resistance committees have not in any way been they haven't been centered in a meaningful way, even if a handful of them, handpicked, individuals might have been present at some of these meetings. They have not been centered, and their kind of vision for what the future looks like has not been taken seriously. I also don't think they've been taken seriously as political actors, even though many of its members are, have been leading the relief efforts in Sudan. They've been the ones keeping people alive, essentially, through this network of emergency response rooms, through which young people are driving ambulances and organizing communal kitchens, turning schools into shelters. They're, they're organizing learning activities for children, women's kind of response rooms, crisis centers. You name it, they're essentially filling the role of a civilian state with very little support from the international community. It's mostly diaspora support. And so for them to be taking on that role in the absence, of an international aid community, again, there are international NGOs operating, but not at the level that is needed. And also, I should mention that only 2.6% of the $3 billion needed to launch an adequate response effort to keep people from starving to death, essentially, has been received by the international community. So given that they are filling the role of an absent kind of civilian state, they should be taken much more seriously, and they have not. Instead, we have these civilian elites who have their own agenda, which I don't think is in line with what people in Sudan need, who are kind of stuck in the middle of this senseless violence.
And as you're talking about the resistance committees, I wanted just to expand a bit more on the critical role that the resistance committees have been playing. I mean, playing before, during, and after the revolution. And particularly when you mentioned they're setting up the emergency response rooms, the ERRs. And how is that going, particularly now as you're seeing reports that they're being attacked by both sides? Yes. Of the armed forces, and but just telling us you mentioned it in passing as you were talking just a few minutes ago all of the work that they're doing, but really, if you can just give us more, unpack it further so that we clearly understand what they're up against and also what they are achieving with such against tremendous odds.
Mm-hmm. Yes. No, I mean, I think they deserve so much praise, and I wish that more journalists and stories would focus on them. One thing, as you noted, which is very true, is that they are responding to people's needs, to people's dire needs, right? They're mostly operating in areas that are hard hit by the war, and, in some cases, in areas like Khartoum, where there's still active fighting, Darfur as well, and also in areas where there's large displaced communities. One of the things that I think is important to note is, as you mentioned, they've been targeted by both the RSF and the army, detained, imprisoned, tortured, in some cases raped. Some have even been killed. And so they're doing this work of responding to people's needs at great risk to themselves. And they're being targeted as kind of revolutionaries and as providers of aid, right? Because aid has been instrumentalized in terrible ways by the RSF in particular. And it's been obstructed, right? It's been hard for them in recent weeks, especially. So one of the things I should mention is that beginning in December, after the Jazeera was invaded by the RSF, which is the area of the agricultural heartland just south of Khartoum, there was an internet blackout, which to some degree continues. There are still family members that I have not been able to get in touch with now for months, right? And it's quite difficult, actually, to get phone service and internet, which means that interrupts our ability to send money, because most of the ways that we're able to send money is through something called Bankuk. It's an app that you need the internet for. So that's been very complicated. And people had until then kind of survived by receiving money on their apps and then transferring it through the app to a store owner, say, to buy food. But in the absence of the internet, it's been much harder. You know, you have to then travel to get food, and it's dangerous, right, to do that, because anytime you travel, you can get targeted. And so I think that's, you know, their work has gotten so much harder because of this internet blackout, because of the ways that aid is being obstructed, because of the acute food shortages that have also been impacted by this internet blackout. And so, you know, they're quite creative. I mean, they're like creative geniuses in the ways that they've been able to source food and medicine in particular, like by liaising with store owners and pharmacists, et cetera, and they get it at the best price possible, to the point where before the war, because we've raised through the collective, you know, significant amount of money that we've been sending to these ERRs across the country, in Darfur, in Khartoum. We've also sent to Port Sudan and Kassala. And those are areas that are more controlled by the army. And, you know, I remember before the internet blackout, $700, let me make sure, yeah, so for $700, they were able to feed 50 families in one of the communal kitchens on the outskirts of Khartoum for a whole month, one main meal a day. And that was a really critical meal. And when the internet blackout started, many of those communal kitchens had to shut down because they just weren't able to source the food anymore or to receive the funds they needed to keep them running. So I think that is something to note. And, you know, for anyone who's listening, if you're interested in supporting these groups, you can donate through SudanSolidarity.com. Your dollar will go a lot further because it's entirely volunteer run than if you donate to one of these large international NGOs who themselves are now funneling resources and money to these local responders because they're better able to reach the people most in need. And yet, to me, it's also quite sad that we've gotten to this point because there's no protection, there's no international protection for these local responders. And that is really what was the sort of bare minimum that should have been on the table at these negotiations, right? How do we open up corridors for humanitarian aid to get into the areas hardest hit? And how do we protect the people who are distributing and aid and, you know, feeding people and helping people?
You're listening to a recent conversation with Dr. Nasreen El Amin, who is assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and Department of African Studies at the University of Toronto. The conversations unpack the war situation in Sudan. The music in the background from Sudan is Al Amal by Nori and is Dorpa Band. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation. I wonder if you could say that the place where people can help, you said this is SudanSolidarityEffort.com.
Yeah, the website is SudanSolidarity.com, and so you can donate there. We're revamping the website at the moment, but that's one way people can support.
SudanSolidarity.com. And then also the app that you mentioned, if you could say that again, the name of the app that people have been using.
It's called Bunkuk. It's like a banking app, essentially, that is allowed, you know, that's kind of how we, we have our own fiscal sponsor here in Canada, so people can make a tax-deductible donation in Canada. And I should also mention, there is a U.S. Kind of version of us, I would say. It's called Al Sandug, that is doing something very similar for people who want to, you know, give tax-deductible donations in the U.S. They're also supporting emergency response rooms, and we work together sometimes.
Yeah, on that note, I wanted also to expand on the people-to-people solidarity that Sudanese are looking for. Beyond the international agencies, which you have all sorts of the political maneuverings going on in those arenas, these are two ways that people could, you know, the ones we just mentioned, and what other aspects can people be in solidarity with Sudanese people? Ordinary citizens, not ordinary citizens, citizens of whether they're in the United States or Canada, can be in solidarity with Sudanese.
No, that's a great question. You know, I think on the immigration front, there needs to be a lot more pressure on our politicians to pass, you know, laws, programs, create programs that would enable Sudanese refugees to seek refuge in North America. And in a way, I mean, we have a kind of humanitarian pathways law that was just signed, you know, kind of opened up in Canada to unite Sudanese citizens with their Canadian family members. But it's actually quite, the bureaucracy and the money involved in qualifying for that program makes it almost impossible for people to be eligible. On one side, you have a requirement for families in Canada to have a, you know, a certain amount of money and to be able to sponsor people in a way that isn't quite realistic. And on the other hand, you have requirements around biometrics and people trying to get to Canadian embassies. It's almost impossible. So, you know, in the past, Canada has kind of eliminated all those barriers for Ukrainian citizens, and the same should be done for Sudanese. In the U.S., I would point to organizations like the Black Alliance for Just Immigration and African Communities Together, who've been working with Sudanese people to come up with ideas for how to create more just, humane immigration policies towards Sudanese people. And in general, I would say it shouldn't just be about family reunification, right? I mean, as I mentioned, we're dealing with the largest internal displacement crisis in the world in Sudan, and yet there haven't been any special programs rolled out for us. And that needs to start happening, but I think that can only happen if the pressure is coming from people beyond the Sudanese diaspora, because the diaspora is not that big. And so that's one thing. And I think the other thing is to really connect the struggles, right? I mean, I think many people talk about the movement for Free Palestine as having, you know, taken away the attention from Sudan. And I just don't think that's true. I think there was never enough attention to begin with on Sudan. And I think in many ways, the activism around Palestine has actually opened up the space for North Americans to want to know more about Sudan. And it is now, I think, our job to kind of connect the dots, right? Who are the weapons manufacturing companies that are making a profit here off of both wars, right? And you know, also the Congo and Haiti, you know, who are like, what are the corporate, the sort of, I call them the network of murderers, if you will, right? Like, who are they? And how can we identify them? How can we figure out if our universities are investing in them and pressure them to divest, right? I think those are some things that not only, even if we don't achieve, say, divestment as the end goal, I think even in mobilizing around that, it can draw more people into learning about what's happening in Sudan and just mobilize more kind of awareness around what is happening. And then that can feed into the existing advocacy efforts. And anywhere you are in the US, there is probably a Sudanese community diaspora group that is organizing around Sudan. So I urge you to connect with them and to find out how you can support. There's lots going on. People are very, very, very active and in a quite coordinated way, I would say. That's what I would say.
And do you have any other closing thoughts before we end the session?
I mean, I just want to urge your listeners to, you know, and I know that your the folks who listen to your show are probably do not fall under this category, but I want to urge everybody to not naturalize this war, to not think of it as, you know, well, this is just what happens in that part of the world, but to really ask the critical questions and to push, you know, whichever news media you rely on, push them to cover what is happening and to feature Sudanese journalists who are on the ground. There are some logistical issues, I think, surrounding why, you know, we haven't heard more about Sudan. There's, of course, anti-Black racism. And then, of course, there's the fact that U.S. allies are deeply implicated. And so I think we just need to be more critical. You know, what's the word, like, engage more critically with the media that we consume and push back. That's I think what I would like to leave people with.
Dr. Nasreen Al-Amin, thank you very much for being on the show again with us, and we look forward to having you back so that you can unpack the situation. And we hope there's peace soon in the country.
Thank you so much for having me. And I hope so too.
You've just been listening to a recent conversation with Dr. Nasreen El Amin. She is the assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and Department of African Studies at the University of Toronto, and is a member of the Sudan Solidarity Collective in Canada. The conversation unpacked the war situation in Sudan. Now we're going to feature a recent conversation I had with Diana Konate. She's the Deputy Executive Director of Policy and Advocacy for African Communities Together, that's ACT, and she's discussing further solidarity efforts with Sudanese locally in the DMV and nationally in the U.S. to address the impacts of the one-year war. The music in the background is Jabana by Nori and his Dopa Band from Sudan. Now here's the conversation with Diana Konate. Diana Konate, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us to talk about how people can be in solidarity with Sudanese dealing with the war, which has been ongoing for a year now. But before we get deep into the conversation, please describe the general mission of African Communities Together, ACT.
Sure. ACT is an organization that was founded in 2012 by an Ethiopian immigrant here in the U.S. And the mission of the organization, we're an organization of African immigrants here in the U.S. and our families. And the mission is to empower African immigrants to integrate socially here, to get ahead economically and to engage civically. A few of the things that we do at the organization is to connect African immigrants with services, to help develop them as leaders, and to help organize them around issues that matter. So I focus on the advocacy piece of our work. And pushing for laws and policies that benefit African immigrants.
Well, thanks for that. And as you're aware, because of the war in Sudan, which is going to be 1 year in the making on April 15th, there have been over 8 million Sudanese who have been displaced internally and as refugees abroad. As you're talking about the mission of ACT, what is ACT doing as it pertains to Sudanese in need of help here in the U.S.?
Sure. So our membership includes a significant Sudanese population. And so we've been very active with the Sudanese community. And we've done two specific things. One, we've worked to ensure that the Sudanese who are currently living in the U.S. Under TPS status, temporary protected status, remain protected and that they don't lose their status and lose that protection, particularly, specifically, that protection from deportation, given what's happening in Sudan right now. So that's one piece. And then the second piece is asking the administration to create a humanitarian parole program for Sudanese who are outside of the U.S. Trying to flee the war. We currently have, as I mentioned, Sudanese members within our membership. A lot of them still have family in Sudan, or some have been able to get their families out of Sudan, but are trying to be reunited with their families or trying to bring them here. And so similar to other populations, specifically the Ukraine the Ukrainians following the Ukraine war, a humanitarian parole program was created for that population, and we would like to see something similar created for the Sudanese population.
Do you have a specific number of Sudanese in the area? Well, I'd say in the area, when I say the area, I mean the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, and then also nationally.
That number, I don't have it off the top of my head. I should have come prepared with that, but I don't have it off the top of my head. But there is, especially in the in this area, I'm in the D.C. area. There's a large Sudanese population in the D.C. area, specifically in Virginia. That's where a lot of our members are located.
Again, that's Diana Konate. She is the Deputy Executive Director of Policy and Advocacy for African Communities Together. That's ACT. And we're speaking about solidarity with Sudanese dealing with the war in Sudan, which is 1 year in the making as of April 15th. And as we're talking about nationally and locally, what are the pending work in terms of appraising lawmakers locally and nationally in the United States?
So we have been having conversations with members of Congress specifically to, appraise them of the situation happening in Sudan right now. Unfortunately, it's not something that is, constantly in our media in the way that it should be. So we feel that, continuing to have conversations with lawmakers to let them know that, hey, this situation is still ongoing. There's been no resolution. People continue to suffer. And the U.S. needs to do as much as it can to protect people. Those are conversations that we continue to have with members of Congress.
And what specific activities are coming up that people can be in solidarity with Sudanese, which ACT is involved in?
Sure. So on the 15th of April, there will be a rally in front of the White House it begins at 12 p.m., I want to say, Eastern Time. And that's one way that folks can get involved. The rally itself will be broader than just humanitarian parole for Sudan, but definitely a way that people can come out, people should come out on that day to be in solidarity with the Sudanese community. Whether or not people are Sudanese, I think that this is really a time when we need to stand in solidarity with our brothers and sisters from Sudan.
And before we go, I also wanted to find out what other ways can people in the U.S. Beyond the African diaspora community specifically to be in support of in solidarity with Sudanese?
Sure. One of the things that I often tell people is to just be aware of what's happening. To not forget that, there is still a conflict happening in Sudan, despite the fact that it might not be, front page news in the media, but to stay aware and to help support us in putting pressure on the government to protect Sudanese by creating a humanitarian parole program. Follow some of the Sudanese leaders who have been working very diligently on this issue to bring a resolution and to bring peace in the country, and support their efforts as well.
And I also wanted to remind people about the rally in March that's taking place on April 15th, which will be the day that marks 1 year of the a war that's taking place in Sudan. The title of the rally is United for Sudan. rally and march, and that's at the Freedom Plaza here in Washington, D.C. And it's going to also feature a march to the White House at 12, that's at 12 p.m. And you should RSVP at Eventbrite, search under United for Sudan. And there are many organizations, including ACT, which Diana is part of. And as I mentioned before, Diana Konate is the Deputy Executive Director of Policy and Advocacy for African Communities Together. That's ACT. And that's one of the organizations sponsoring the march. The other ones are Refugees International, American Friends Service Committee, Amnesty International, Advocacy Network for Africa, ADNA, which for full disclosure, I'm a member of, and many other organizations. And again, go to Eventbrite, search under United for Sudan for that important march and rally on April 15th. Diana, do you have any other closing thoughts before we go?
Okay, sure. So I just wanted to clarify that ACT is not a sponsor of the rally, but we are participating. So I just want to make sure that credit goes to the organizations that are putting this, to the correct organizations that are leading that effort and putting the rally together.
Thanks for that correction. Any other closing thoughts?
And then also to add a follow up on a question you had about the number of Sudanese living in the U.S. I was able to pull that up as we spoke. And there are over 51,000 Sudanese here in the U.S. So a very large African immigrant population here. And a significant number live in the Virginia area here. Over 4,000 are here in the Virginia area. So that's one of the biggest populations in the states.
Thank you very much for that information. And also, thank you very much also for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us. And we look forward to also touching base further on this important critical issue.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for uplifting this very important issue at this critical time.
That was a recent conversation with Diana Konate, Deputy Executive Director of Policy and Advocacy for African Communities Together. And she was discussing further solidarity efforts with Sudanese locally in the DMV and nationally in the U.S. to address the impacts of the one-year war in Sudan. Earlier, we had on the show Dr. Nasreen El Amin, who is assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and Department of African Studies at the University of Toronto, and is a member of the Sudan Solidarity Collective in Canada. The conversations dissected the war situation in Sudan, looking at the internal players and the role of multinational corporations, historic neoliberal policies which have undermined the country's food production, the tremendous role of the resistance committees in addressing the needs of the people, the solidarity efforts with Sudanese from abroad, and more. The music in the background is Yarabi by Sona Jobate. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shao Anana, Uzen Alamin, and that's followed by the Women's Collective, Sophie's Parlor. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host, James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nasella, Claire Chapman, and Deante Pileta. Thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Kozer and Funangonda, and our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Oderson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you this closing song entitled God Bless the Child by Billie Holiday, commemorating her birthday, which is the 7th of April, and also commemorating Jazz Appreciation Month. And also, as we remember the children in Sudan. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
Them that's got shall have. Them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have. Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, April 10th, 2024. Here are some headlines. Six former Mississippi police officers who nicknamed themselves the Goon Squad were sentenced today to prison terms of 15 to 45 years on state charges for the torture of two black men. The white officers had already been convicted and sentenced on federal charges for the brutal attack on Michael Corey Jenkins and Eddie Terrell Parker in January 2023, and will serve their terms concurrently. The attack took place during a warrantless raid on a private home, during which the former officers handcuffed, kicked, waterboarded, and attempted to sexually assault the two men over the course of 2 hours. The incident garnered national attention given the brazen, racist nature of the assault. In more legal news, former Trump Organization Chief Financial Officer Alan Weisselberg was sentenced today to 5 months in jail for lying under oath during his testimony in former President Donald Trump's civil fraud trial and during the investigation that preceded it. Weisselberg had pleaded guilty last month to 2 counts of perjury, including telling the court he had no idea how a Trump property value was inflated on financial documents. Weisselberg already served 100 days in jail last year for tax fraud after he pleaded guilty to 15 felony counts related to his compensation while working at the Trump Organization. His legal fees are being paid by the Trump Company, where he worked for nearly half a century. In other news, the Environmental Protection Agency today issued the first ever national rule to limit the presence of certain PFAS, or so-called forever chemicals, in drinking water. These chemicals have been linked to cancers, liver damage, as well as developmental damage in children. Contamination exposure has also been found to disproportionately affect communities of color. The new rule is expected to reduce exposure to the highly toxic chemicals for about 100 million people. Public water systems have 5 years to implement solutions to reduce PFAS in their water. Starting in 2029, water systems with levels of PFAS that violate the regulation will be required to notify the public and take action to reduce the levels of PFAS. And the FAA says it is investigating new whistleblower claims made by a Boeing quality engineer that accuse Boeing of poor safety standards. The whistleblower alleges the company is employing shortcuts in the assembly process of 787 Dreamliners that could possibly compromise the structural integrity of the aircraft. This comes amid a series of high-profile incidents involving Boeing's aircrafts, In the past few months, planes have lost landing gears, door panels, and just this week, a Boeing plane was forced to land after an engine cover came off. A Senate subcommittee has called Boeing CEO David Calhoun to testify next week regarding the safety of the company's aircrafts. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 70.